Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to May's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce to you our speaker for today, RCVS and European Specialist in Veterinary Anesthesia, Louise Clark. Thank you, Louise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi, good afternoon everybody, and thank you very much for joining us on this webinar. Let's hope all the technical stuff works well, but what we're going to be talking about today is something that hopefully we don't see too often in practice, but when we do see it, it can be very frightening, it's challenging to deal with, and a lot of us don't have very much confidence in doing it because it's a long time since we last did it, and we haven't been taught specifically what the best way to do things are. Given that guidance relating to CPR changes quite frequently, the purpose of this webinar today is really to talk about the current guidelines, what we should be doing, and to try and improve our effectiveness when we actually have to do this so that we can optimize outcome. Really, what we want is the best possible outcome for each and every patient. And probably the most important thing about today is improving your confidence. There isn't anything in here that's particularly technically difficult. It's really about being able to do it in a timely and effective manner, and you being sure that you're doing the right thing, and that's always, it's always a good thing to feel about. So ultimately, you're going to be delivering better CPR to your patients when the necessity does arise. So the way we'll structure this webinar is we'll talk a little bit about the evidence base for what we're going to be doing, why do we do it, how we do it, and then we'll talk a bit about how best to prepare for CPR. There's certain steps that you can take which will make doing CPR easier and a little less stressful. Then we'll go through some of the practicalities, what you actually have to do when you're faced with this, when it's right in front of you, and hopefully when you're successful, what do we do afterwards? And this is a little bit out with the scope of the presentation. So I've put some information in there for you to refer back to later, but we'll cover it fairly briefly. So, evidence for CPR practice, unfortunately, in veterinary patients is pretty limited. There are very few clinical studies. There's quite a lot of research studies out there, but bleeding pigs out does not equate to dealing with the clinical cases that we have to do on a regular basis. So, a few years ago, the American College of Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care tried to do, if you like, a synthesis of evidence looking at human evidence, veterinary clinical evidence, and veterinary research evidence. And 3 years ago, they published in JVEX what they call the RECOVER guidelines. These are as much evidence base as we have for the CPR that we carry out now, and they're basically the guidelines that we're going to be talking about today. They're based on a mixture of true evidence and on gaining multiple expert opinion. These will be revised within the next couple of years, so it's quite possible that if we were to do this webinar again in a couple of years' time, some of their, if you like, some of their guidelines, some of their recommendations will change. If we look at CPR outcomes, this is the first thing when I teach this at work, there's always a big negative, why do we bother? Nothing survives. And if you look at survival to discharge rates in the veterinary literature, they're actually very poor. They're between 2 and 10% for dogs and cats. And that's despite a return of spontaneous circulation rate of between 35 and 45%. So why does this happen? Well, it may be that when we do get a return to spontaneous circulation, we're not managing these patients as well as we can. There's quite a lot of ongoing pathology that if we don't deal with, we don't give them the best outcome. There is also an issue about patient selection. Most of this data comes out of America, and in the US, there is a tendency to attempt to resuscitate all patients, and that often includes patients who, frankly, are not resuscitatable. We all have to die at some point, and if we attempt to resuscitate those who will not be resuscitated, then we will make the data look actually worse than it is. We also have to remember that if we do 1 in 10 CPRs and that patient goes home neurologically intact and is fine, then that's a big difference to that owner, and that pet owner relationship. We ha actually had a case last week that arrested and has gone home and is doing extremely well, and that makes it all worthwhile. We also need to think, when we're thinking about these candidates for CPR, who is likely to survive. Anesthesia always gets it as being a situation where we're likely to have to do CPR. And obviously, as an anesthetist, I have a bit of a chip on my shoulder. Anesthesia-related cardiopulmonary arrest is actually pretty rare if anesthesia is managed well. The reason for that is that with good monitoring, you will detect an incipient arrest and be able to deal with it before it actually happens. But if you do have a cardiac arrest under anesthesia, because the patient was pretty healthy beforehand, your chances of a good outcome are actually pretty high. So anesthesia-related cardiopulmonary arrest is actually associated with one of the best outcomes, but it's actually much better avoided, and effective management and monitoring will help you do that. Other than that, who else is going to survive? Well, if the arrest is witnessed, that's always helpful. And in human practice, they have what they call the H's and the T's. And these are the situations where we're most likely to get a patient successfully through CPR. So these are situations such as hypoxia. Did somebody forget to turn the oxygen on during anesthesia? Or did the patient get hypoxic because of an airway obstruction? That's the most common documented cause in veterinary medicine. So, the pug, the brachycephalic, the post-dental airway obstruction, they're the most common ones that we are aware of from the data that we have. Hypovolemia, as a result of potentially surgical misadventure or trauma. Hypovolemia, if corrected rapidly and effectively, tends to get a good outcome. Metabolic causes that are dealt with very quickly, you can also get a good outcome. And hypothermia, there's a lot of work being done in human practice to basically say you're not dead until you're warm and dead. We don't see thrombosis as much as in human practice, but tension pneumothorax is another one where appropriate rapid decompression of a pneumothorax will allow a very, very effective CPR and a good outcome. Cardiac tamponade and potentially access to toxins. So these are the patients that, if we know about the cause, we can deal with very effectively and get good outcomes. But there are also patients who we shouldn't be resuscitating. Unfortunately, we don't have much objective data as to which patients these should be, but I would say we should not attempt to resuscitate all cases. Certainly, if somebody had attempted to resuscitate my old dog, I would have thought ethically it was completely unacceptable. We all die at some point. It's a very difficult conversation to have, but we have it quite regularly with owners. Any patient coming into our ICU, sort of high dependency care, patients that we are worried about, we will have that conversation. And it's mu actually much easier to have it in a calm, controlled situation where, yeah, there's a lot of emotion, but owners are able to often make a rational decision, especially if they're given a little bit of time to say, actually, we accept that attempting to resuscitate this patient is not the right thing to do. So things like end-stage cardiac disease, very severe respiratory disease, those cases. Actually, we're not doing them a favor by attempting to resuscitate them, and we actually label their notes to that extent to say that we've had that conversation, and it's always done with informed consent from the owner. But it also means that it avoids the team, nurses, vets having to go through the stress of performing what they know will be a pointless CPR on a patient who actually needs to be given the dignity to die. And I think that's really important. And it's something that's actually, over the last few years, made a change to our practice. And actually, when we audit, it improved our CPR outcomes because we're only doing it in the patients who we actually think we can make a difference with. What we do need to be aware of, though, is if we caused the cardiac arrest, then we certainly need to do something about it. So in that situation, we're talking about anesthetic related arrest. We may also be talking about something like a tension pneumothorax after a bronchoalveolar lavage, And maybe a venous air embolism after somebody didn't run the giving set through correctly. Things that do happen, believe me, I've seen all of these more than once. In that situation, we have to attempt to resuscitate, but we're also dealing with patients who we have a good chance of actually resuscitating. We also need to think about open chest CPR. There's a cohort of patients that we will talk about later who will not resuscitate with closed chest CPR for lots of reasons. Do we want to progress down that route? That relies on us having the skills to do it. I'm very fortunate. I work in a situation where I've got brilliant surgeons around and we can open a chest very quickly if we need to. But it is not appropriate in many cases. As a guidance, when we audited, we do between 30 and 40 CPRs a year in my practice, and we probably only open one chest or maybe two. So resuscitation guidance is the first step in your effective CPR. So what we're going to talk about now practically is basic life support. Do we go for airway breathing circulation, as I was taught when I was at vet school, or circulation airway breathing? And if so, why? Talk a little bit about advanced life support, so drugs and electrical defibrillation, and there's further notes on follow-up as well. We are fundamentally going to concentrate on the actual CPR mechanisms itself in order to try and get as much useful information to you as possible. So, to start with, the crash trolley. Where do I find it? I hope everyone has one in their practice, and I hope that everybody in their practice, including the receptionists, including all the auxiliary staff, know where it is. It's really important to know that. Beyond that, it's also really important to know where will we do CPR. If a patient, for example, crashes in a consult room, do we take the equipment to the patient or do we take the patient to the equipment? That might be a little bit dependent upon your situation, how your building is laid out, and that will ultimately affect how you stock your crash trolley or your crash box. Do you need everything in it, or are you able to move the patient to an area, say there's a prep room that's accessible to all the consult rooms? That might be the best place to attempt resuscitation, and that may well have things like endotracheal tubes immediately available. So just think about that, because then when it happens, the team will know where they need to be and what they need to do. It's a really good idea to mock this up on a fairly regular basis. We do repeated training, and it really does make a difference, and I can tell you about that later. But if everybody knows where we're going to be and what we're going to do, it really helps. So we do a kind of run-through with all the staff when they start. We go through it in a lot of detail, and then we refresh their training on a regular basis. So it's good fun as well. Get a soft toy out and do it. With your crash trolley or crash box, make somebody responsible for it. Make sure that they look at the contents, they restock it regularly. Decide whether you're going to have your resuscitation drugs pre-drawn or not. We do, but that's partly because we have a lot of these events and it's worth it. They're cheap drugs. We don't want anybody getting sharps injuries. That's really your, personal decision. What's in there, and when we last had a CPR, did we use everything in there or did we need other stuff that's not in there? Just think about it every time. Have you got a CPR algorithm? The one I'm going to show you from the RECOVER guidelines, which the link is there, is a really easy one to follow. There's a lot of evidence from human practice that actually having an algorithm, and the study they looked was on an iPhone, but however, allows you to be more effective. Don't think that you should know exactly what you're doing. Algorithms and dosing charts are really, really useful. Have them laminated, have them available, and make sure your dosing charts are on body weight rather than mgs per kg, because that's what you're practically going to be faced with. How many mils for a 20-kilogram dog of this drug? Record what you're doing. Try and record it contemporaneously so that you can follow things very clearly, and that if there is any, if you like, comeback afterwards, you know exactly what was done. It is difficult, but it's really, really useful. We actually have CPR charts and we just circle things as they're done so that we know exactly what we've done. And the other thing that is really useful, it can be quite traumatic and it's meant to be a constructive process, is to do a debrief afterwards. Get everybody together who is involved. Firstly, tell them how well they've done to attempt this, and then break that down and see what was done well and what was not done so well. We've done this in developing our training and made sure that, over time, all the things that have been published, we now implement, and we've actually audited that and seen that we're doing a lot better. And we've changed the way that we deliver training to the nurses to make it more practical. None of us is perfect, and you need to try and make it best for your situation. And the nurses like the time and investment that you're putting into them as well. So if this happens, how are you going to get help in your practice? It might be stick your head around the corner and yell. It might be that you can use, where I used to work, we had a tannoy system that was designed to give out a message that didn't upset clients. Where I work now, we have quite a complicated crash button system that goes to a pager. It really is what's appropriate, but you do not want to be standing there with a patient who's had a cardiac arrest and know that there are five other people in the building, but that you can't get to them. So think about how you're going to get them to help you as quickly as possible, because time is really, really important in this situation. So we've got all our equipment. We know that we're going to train our people. We know that we can get hold of them. How many of them do we actually need to do CPR effectively? Well, actually, probably quite a few. And ideally, in the big human crash teams, the team leader is actually an observer, but they're gathering information and using that information to get the best possible outcome. So they will be, in the case of a human team, working out exactly what's happened to this patient, making sure that somebody gets hold of relatives, all those kind of things. In our situation, we're going to have to concentrate on having a number of people that is practical for our situation. What I would say is that it is absolutely no good the team leader being involved in chest compressions, at least not beyond the first cycle, because they cannot concentrate on other things, get information in, make decisions when they themselves are hypoxic because they're working out like they're in the gym. So probably the best thing for the team leader to be doing is breathing for that for that patient, because you can be standing up, you can be looking around, you can be assessing the situation, and you can be ventilating that patient. If you're doing pretty much anything else, drawing up drugs, recording, all those things, it's pretty hard to have an overview of what's going on. That's really a personal opinion based on a lot of experience, but that's how it works for us. And what you need to be able to do is make sure that everybody in that team has an idea of what they should be doing, so they therefore can kind of get on with it without too much direction. And the other thing that's really useful, and this is probably a later stage when you're getting quite slick at it, is what we call closed loop communication. So it's no good just yelling, "I need some adrenaline." You need to direct the request, ideally to a specific person by name. And when that person does that job, they hand you the adrenaline, the epinephrine, they tell you that they have given you the epinephrine. And then it is recorded when that is administered. So it makes it really easy to avoid mistakes, that the person in charge knows that the correct drug has been administered and at exactly what time. It's a bit like you'll hear it's a military system, such that the command is repeated back when the job is done. And it does help in a really fraught situation to make sure that everything gets done. You can kind of tick off what's actually been done as it goes through. So get to our patient. Most of you will have seen the Vinnie Jones, the things on telly regarding bystander CPR, and that in humans, compressions only CPR is very much advocated. There are differences between our patients and humans, but there are also similarities. You need to be aware that ventilation is completely ineffective without compressions. If you're delivering oxygen into the lungs, but there's no blood flow through the lungs, it's not going to do anything. So you must never delay compressions, even in our patients. But in our patients, the primary cause of cardiac arrest is not what I call McDonald's overdose and myocardial infarction. And that's what happens in people. That's why they arrest generally in ventricular fibrillation, generally well oxygenated, and generally with an open airway. And that means that compressions-only CPR is a useful technique. In our patients, however, many of the arrests that we have the literature for are due to airway obstruction. Our patients are also relatively easy to intubate compared to the average human. You do not need to paralyze them, and nearly all veterinary nurses and certainly all veterinary surgeons are able to intubate most patients. So ideally, we want to never ever compromise starting compressions, but we want to restore the airway as soon as we possibly can. Slightly different from human practice, and as we get more and more evidence from hopefully the next set of RECOVER guidelines, we'll know which patients we can, we might be modifying this with, but that's what we are being told that we should do at the moment. So what we're going to do is break down what we do. All this ideally will happen over a very short period of time. Time from witnessed arrest to an animal being effectively brain dead is 6 minutes. Time from witnessed arrest to definitely getting some kind of brain damage without effective CPR is about 4 minutes. So what we're saying is from the time of witnessed arrest to you getting an effective circulation to resupply oxygenated blood to the heart and to the brain, they're the two most fundamental organs, you've got less than 4 minutes. So you haven't got much time. So a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is actually almost happening in parallel, but we're going to break it down so that it happens sequentially to try and make it nice and clear. The first thing is, if you think an animal has had a cardiac arrest, but you're not 100% sure, start CPR. You're not going to do any damage, and pulse palpation is horribly insensitive. Get the patient onto a hard surface. Those of you who remember the Michael Jackson scenario, chest compressions on a divan bed do not work. Equally on an orthopedic mattress, they do not work. So get them out of the kennel. If they're in a kennel, get them into some space to work wherever they are. Get them onto a hard surface and get help. Don't spend too much time trying to decide if you need help or not. By the time help arrives, you may be a minute and 90 seconds into that 4 minutes. If you think you need help, get it straight away. If the situation's not that bad, most people won't mind. Sure, they don't want to be called on a weekly basis, but you'd much rather that they were there and actually the situation isn't as bad as you think. So what we're going to do is go through essentially the CPR algorithm that's published by the RECOVER guidelines. This is an open access thing. You can use it for any kind of education. So feel free to print it out, stick it on your wall so that people know what they're doing. So we're going to be starting with chest compressions. Sounds really obvious, but almost invariably when I get people to demonstrate this or new staff, they do it badly. And this is what is driving the blood through the br to the brain of the animal and maintaining them alive, if you like. If it's done well, you can get up to 30% of normal cardiac output. If it's done badly, you're effectively not going to be doing anything for that patient. So you need to have them, as I said, on a hard surface with your body weight above the patient, not leaning. Ideally, we'd put the spine towards the person doing the chest compressions. This matters more in a big dog than in a small dog. And we want to make sure that we are in a position to be able to deliver chest compressions for 2 minutes, 2 whole minutes without stopping. This is really important because it's not done very well globally, and that includes in human practice. People want to know that things are going well, so they stop to see if there's a pulse come back, they stop to do all sorts of things. You want to try and avoid stopping at all. because this is when you're trying to get blood supply back to that brain, back to that heart. So 2 minutes of compressions, 2 minutes with monitoring, and you don't stop for a whole 2 minutes. If you have to change the operator within that 2 minutes because they're not effective or for some other reason, you need to synchronize that so there isn't a break in what you're actually doing. So depending on how big your patient is, you need to think about what your approach to CPR is. They divide the mechanisms of blood flow in CPR into a couple of different, if you like, methods. And this is applies really if you think about very small patients and much bigger patients. In the small patients, generally less than about 7 or 8 kilos, and in deep and narrow bleeds, I'm thinking about things like Italian Greyhounds, Whippets, you can actually feel where the apex beat should be, and you can compress over that area. So cats, small dogs, you want to be compressing over where you think the apex beat should be. In bigger dogs, you are not going to be able to compress the heart in order to compress the chambers effectively. And so what we rely on is a change in pressure in the chest. And we'll look at this a bit more to try and make it a bit more clear. So in a small patient, so if we think about this being our Italian Greyhound, you're directly compressing the ventricles, and blood is forced from those ventricles into the aorta and into the pulmonary artery via the open valves, and the valves passively close behind your compression. So essentially, you're making the heart do its normal job, but with external compression. So you're squashing it and releasing it, squashing it and releasing it, and you get a filling action by the squashing, releasing, and a pumping action by the squashing and releasing. So that's quite straightforward to see how that would happen, and it's most appropriate cats, small dogs. In a small cat, you're going to be using your flat of your fingers. Don't use the tips of your fingers, they're just ineffective. In a slightly bigger dog, use your whole hand. In a much bigger dog, if we think about, for example, a Newfoundland, there's no way that you can compress its heart. What you're going to be doing here is compressing over the widest part of the chest, which is really just as you look at it, wherever it looks biggest, at about the level of the costochondral junction. And as you apply pressure, you're literally squashing the intrathoracic vessels. The intrathoracic pressure increases, and the pressure gradient increases. And then as you go, by squashing the chest, the heart's effectively acting as a passive conduit, and it's just blood is just going through as you squash and release. And it's actually the release that is really important, because as you release, intrathoracic pressure falls and venous flow goes to the right side of the heart and the lungs and back round to give you preload via suction effect. So in these big dogs, you're compressing on the widest part of the chest and releasing completely, and particularly in these guys, it's the release that actually, if you like, sucks blood back to the heart so that you can push it round the whole circulation again. So it doesn't matter that you don't know where the heart is, you're just using Boyle's law, changing the pressure in the chest in order to be able to push and pull blood round. This is quite important when we're thinking about how effective we're being and what other forces are going to stop us doing good CPR. So ideally, we're going to have our patient in lateral recumbency, and the textbooks say right lateral recumbency. The primary reason for that is so that if we do need to open the chest, it's easier to actually access the heart. In reality, that's not a big deal. If the patient is in left lateral like this guy and they rest in that position, there's no problem at all. And this is actually from the Cornell guidelines. The patient's in left lateral, it's absolutely fine. Don't turn over a patient initially because they're not in right lateral recumbency. But if they're in sternal, roll them into right. It just gives you better options. So you can see here, just about over the widest part of the chest, but their arms should really be straight. This is much better. This has come from the Vet Times. So that's her copyright. But she really needs to be further in order to optimize how well she's doing her compressions. In dogs that look a bit more like us, where their chest is a little bit flatter and wider, so I'm thinking about things like English Bull Terriers, Staffordshire Bull Terriers, those kind of dogs, then putting the patient in dorsal recumbency often helps because the chest is wide and flat and you can get a more effective change in intrathoracic pressure this way. So start in right lateral by all means, but if you're not doing very well, and we'll look at how we assess how well we're doing, put them on their back. How fast do we go? Well, this has changed quite a lot since I was at vet school. Ideally, if you're old enough to remember, BGs staying alive, and all the vet students I teach know this, so I'm hoping that those of us who are a bit older know it too, you're looking at around about 100 to 120 compressions a minute, and this is regardless of the size of the animal. Not too difficult in a cat, pretty hard work in your Newfoundland, Great Dane, that kind of thing. Higher rates give better outcomes, so it's important to try and maintain that rate, and that you're going to be compressing for 50% of the cycle time and up to a third of the chest diameter. So you can see this is going to be really hard work, which is why 2 minutes is about the maximum that you can do it for and still be effective, unless you're an Olympic athlete. There is some evidence, and I'll mention it at this point, that if you put interposed abdominal compression in there, it actually centralizes the circulation and makes the blood go where you need it, which is to the heart and to the brain. That requires having another person and requires that them being able to put gentle pressure on the abdomen throughout. It's not a requirement, but it's something that we often get asked about, like abdominal binding and abdominal counter pressure. Ideal if you can do it, but we often don't do it. Getting the chest compressions right is much, much more important. So just mention that. And if we do open the chest, I would cross clamp the descending aorta, but that's not something that you're going to be doing very regularly at all. Chest compressions are not benign. They're not high risk, but you will see things, and I've seen all of the following over the years. You will fracture ribs. That does not mean that that's going to be a huge problem, but if you get a return to spontaneous circulation and a successful outcome, that is going to be really painful. You need to be aware of that. You can cause pneumothorax. It's something that you just need to be aware of. Liver rupture is something that will only happen generally if you have too heavy abdominal compression, which is why my caveat. Aspiration pneumonia, I have seen really unfortunately in a patient who was not, the cuff was not inflated on the ET tube. We had a return to spontaneous circulation, a successful outcome, and they died of aspiration pneumonia 2 days later, which was pretty horrible for everybody. Compressing the chest means changing the pressure in the abdomen. If you have a patient particularly who's been dyspneic and aerophagic, you risk pushing a load of gas and a load of stomach contents into the oropharynx and then it being aspirated. That's another good reason to make sure that you intubate them and cuff the tube as soon as possible. And we'll talk a bit more about external chest compression effectiveness monitoring in a bit. But what's really important is that if you are not being effective, you may look like you're being at the gym, but you're doing nothing for this patient. You're working really hard, but their brain is not getting oxygenated blood. It's not being perfused. So you need to think about, can I put this patient on its back if it's a big flat-chested dog? Do I need to sack the boss and take over because they're a bit useless? Do I need to change my technique? Do I need to think about changing from, say, over the heart to over the thorax? Or do I need to actually open this chest? That may or may not be an option depending on facilities, but there is no point converting to open chest CPR if you've had 6 minutes of ineffective closed chest CPR because you're going to do nothing. We already know that the brain will be dead by that point. So if you're ineffective closed, you need to think about open very quickly, and we'll mention that a bit more later. So open chest, just to mention it, you need to think about the morbidity, you need to think about doing it quickly, and you need to think about when you might need it. So you're going to need it when you can't be effective closed. And that's things like thoracic trauma, thoracic surgery. Potentially, if you're in an abdomen, you can go transdiaphragmatically. If you have any pathology that stops you compressing the heart itself or changing the pressure in the chest, you won't be able to do chest compressions. And things like pneumothorax, tension pneumothorax, pleural effusion, pericardial effusion causing tamponade, or a big flail chest will all be reasons why you're unlikely to be able to be effective at closed chest CPR. Now, that might make you say, look, we can go no further with this patient, but it's something that you need to think about as you start CPR. Am I going to be able to do a good job just compressing the chest or compressing over the heart, or do I need to think about being more invasive? Not going to go into the surgery, but remember you're doing a thoracotomy with minimal or a lack of sterile technique. You need to think about how you're going to manage that patient if you are successful. I've seen two patients have open chest CPR and go home fine, but it's not an easy thing to do well. So we're doing our chest compressions. Almost simultaneously, we need to ventilate this patient. It sounds really obvious. We all ventilate patients on a regular basis during anesthesia, but there's just a few things to be aware of, just slightly different. Ideally, we'd like to intubate these patients in lateral, because this means that we're not elevating the head, so lateral with head down. We're not elevating the head and reducing the efficacy of the chest compressions because we're reducing the perfusion pressure. That sounds really obvious, but if you try that in a dyspneic pug, it can be really hard to see what you're doing. So you may need to reposition them in sternal just in order to get the ET tube in. You need to do it under direct visualization. If you only have one laryngoscope in the practice, have it in the crash box. At least twice I've been called to a CPR where the esophagus was intubated. We might as well all go home. It's not like intubating an anaesthetized patient. They have jaw tone. They've probably got loads of debris, may have stuff that they've vomited, they may have all sorts of mucus, they may have blood in their airway. You need to think about potentially suction, dry swabs being available. We use lamming ropes or x-ray ties to hold their mouth open so nobody gets bitten. They may well have an obstruction to their larynx. All these things are things that you don't really think about when we're just intubating for anesthesia, but they're really important. And avoid red rubber ET tubes if you can. The cuffs are horrible. They deflate very easily. They can also get obstructed, and you can't see if there's blood or mucus or debris in the tube. So there's just a couple of things, a couple of other methods of intubation. This is a cat that actually had laryngeal lymphoma and arrested because it just simply couldn't get enough through its airway, and we intubated with a urinary catheter and then cut the end off the urinary catheter and put the tube down it, and that, you know, that was successful. But that does require a little bit of presence of mind to actually be able to do that. Transtracheal oxygen is also another method if you have absolute obstruction at the level of the larynx. Emergency tracheotomy, you're still, even with a good surgeon, you're going to be struggling to do that quickly enough to preserve cerebral oxygenation. So think of another method of getting an airway in. Once you've got the airway established, cuff the tube, particularly in dogs, less worried in cats, because you do that protects the airway from aspiration. An AmbuBag or a breathing system is ideal. These are AmbuBags. They're relatively cheap. It's good idea to have one in or around your crash box, your crash trolley, if you don't have loads of anesthetic machines that you can get to easily. You can attach an oxygen cylinder to this end of them, to the end of them, and that will allow you to actually deliver 100% oxygen to the patient, and that will allow you to effectively use it like a breathing system. despite what we used to be told, the current guidelines that the wig only give 10 breaths a minute and 10 mils per kilo. So that's not actually that much. If you think about it, that's 200 mils to a sort of small Labrador sized dog, and you want an inspiratory time of about a second. The reason for the long expiratory time is that's when there's a lot less pressure in the chest, and it makes it easier for the person doing the chest compressions to actually drive blood round. So breathe in for a second, out for about 5 seconds, very slowly, let the chest completely relax, and then breathe again. Everybody tends to hyperventilate because they're a little bit stressed. Try and do it very smoothly and very gently. You're just going to have to do it on kind of feel, because you're not going to know from capnography or any other method that you'd normally use exactly what's going on. So AmbuBags, very useful. Get 100% oxygen attached to them if you can, otherwise use a breathing system. The breathing system that they use is going to be really dependent on patient size. Ideally, in a bigger patient, I would personally would use a non-rebreathing system, just because if they drop on the floor, then they get broken. They're a lot cheaper than a circle, and they also won't have residual volatile agent in from using them for anesthesia. So I'd probably use a T-piece on anything under about 8 kilos and a Bain breathing system on the bigger patients. Bear in mind, Bains are very efficient during positive pressure ventilation, so even in a massive dog, you'll still be okay with sensible flow rates. So the kind of the take home is gently, not too fast, avoid hyperventilation. The other thing that I would say is see what that chest feels like. You should know what a normal chest feels like during ventilation. If it feels really tight and you can't squeeze the bag, why? Is there an obstruction in the tube? You know, have you got a big clot of blood in there in the cat that's obstructing the tube? Or could you have a pneumothorax, a tension pneumothorax? We actually had this last week. We had a massive tension pneumothorax, and, you know, we just couldn't ventilate the patient, and that is something that you can manage very, very quickly, but you need to be able to recognize it. If I can't squeeze the bag properly, what's going on? And my first thing would be to stick a really big needle in the chest and see if it does anything, because if it isn't a pneumothorax, you're unlikely to cause too much damage in this situation, and if it is, then you deal with it very quickly. So we've now got a patient that we are doing chest compressions on, and we're ventilating, and hopefully we're still within our first 2 minute cycle because we're all very efficient. Now we need to get some monitoring on, and we need to know how effective we are actually being at these chest compressions. So it's no good us being at the gym if the patient's not benefiting. So to give you something to think about, what's the most objective monitor of the effectiveness of your chest compressions? Just think about that for a second. It's actually the end tidal CO2. We think about capnography as being a monitor for ventilation, but actually it's much more than that. It's a monitor of blood flow as well, because we can't transfer CO2 from the tissues to the capnograph without there being some blood flow. So all during the process of cardiac arrest, the tissues are still producing CO2 due to respiration. That CO2 will build up massively in the tissues. It will only get back to your capnograph if there is an effective pulmonary circulation, i.e. a circulation that you are making by actually doing the chest compressions. So if you have a capnograph, if you've got one for anesthetic monitoring, always use it during CPR. Because if you can get a really good CO2 level on your capnograph, you're doing a really good job, and you've effectively buying yourself lots of time to restart this heart, because you're delivering blood to the brain very effectively. They've actually shown that if you can maintain a CO2 of greater than 20 millimeters of mercury, you're doing really well. If you can do more than 15, you get an increased return of spontaneous circulation. But if you've got less than 10, You may be working hard, but for some reason you're being ineffective. So if you consistently get an entitled CO2 of less than 10 and you've checked everything, all the equipment's working, tubes cuffed, everything looks okay, you may be doing a really hard job, but you're not benefiting your patient. You need to think in this circumstance, do I need to open the chest to be effective, or do I need to just stop because we're not doing anything? But if you can maintain a CO2 higher than 15, if you've got it in the teens, you're doing a reasonably good job, you're delivering oxygen because you're getting CO2 back, and therefore you're doing a pretty good job of actually making a circulation for this patient. If you don't have a capnograph, then you need to rely on really probably the best two other things are the presence of a femoral pulse during compression suggests that you've got a reasonable output, assuming you haven't got abdominal binding or abdominal compression. The other thing is if you have a Doppler pulse on the eyeball, that suggests that there's perfusion to the brain. In reality, when the animal's bouncing about doing chest compressions, that's really hard to know. Capnography is a really, really useful thing to have, and it's a really thing to guide your CPR, so always use it if you've got it. The other really nice thing is if you get a sudden return to spontaneous circulation, the circulation will start to work, the heart will start to beat, and it will pick up a load of carbon dioxide, and you'll get a massive increase in your end-tidal CO2, and you know instantly, without looking at anything else, that the patient actually has an output themselves. If anybody has further questions on that, please type them, and I'll see if I can kind of address them later. It's just a time issue. So we're now kind of monitoring what we're doing. We need to think about the advanced life support. Just to mention this, that nurses can only give drugs under direction. So they're perfectly free to give drugs, but make sure that they are given the direction to do that appropriately. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about ECGs to look at our arrhythmias and direct treatment, and a little bit about drugs and a bit about defibrillation as well. So at this point, we're doing chest compressions, we're ventilating, we've got our capnograph on, we know that we are doing a really good job of delivering, of getting CO2 back, so that's delivering oxygen to the patient's brain. We've got an effective circulation. Now we need to move forward to see if we can get the animal's heart to start itself. So if we've got drugs on board that may be causing cardiovascular depression, we need to think at this point about antagonizing them. So if there's alpha-2 agonists on board, give atipamezole. If there are opioids on board, give naloxone. If there are benzodiazepines on board and you've got it, don't worry if you haven't, give flumazenil and give them IV. Don't worry about what the licensing says, do it. Now we need to get an ECG on this patient. This again, hopefully, will be within the first cycle of CPR if we've got our team working well. Make sure that your pads are on well. They need to stay on. Stick them on the animal's pads, tape them on, use crocodile clips. You're going to struggle to see your ECG during chest compressions because you've got so much interference depending on what ECG you've got. If you don't have an ECG, we're going to have to treat this patient as if it's asystolic. In reality, if you don't have an ECG, you're unlikely to have a defibrillator. But if you can't get an ECG, we're going to have to treat the animal as if they're asystolic. But try and get this on as soon as possible. So hopefully, when you change over the person doing the compressions at 2 minutes, you have a really good look at the ECG and you can decide exactly what you're going to do. So the most common ECG that you will see is asystole. Asystole is our most common arrest rhythm, which is good because it's fairly easy to treat. There's a couple of others that you might see. Pulseless electrical activity was formerly known to those older of us who are a bit older as electromechanical dissociation. And this is when the rhythm looks normal, but you don't have the cardiac contraction, or the rhythm looks almost normal. This tends to be seen where you have severe hypovolemia, you have no preload to the heart. Cardiac tamponade and tension pneumothorax are the most common times this happens. So as I said, if you've got a patient who you're getting all this stuff on, you can't ventilate, the ECG looks normal, but there's no output, you need to rule out tension pneumothorax pretty quickly. The other rhythm that we do see is ventricular fibrillation. It's much less common, and in our experience, we tend to see it in cardiac disease, primary cardiac disease. So we'll often see it in things like the Dobermans with DCM and other animals where cardiac disease is a part of their presentation. So say they've got myocarditis secondary to another ongoing metabolic process. So it's less common, but we do see it. So at this point, we've got our ECG, we need to decide what we're going to do with the information that the ECG is giving us. So if we have an animal who is in ventricular fibrillation or pulseless ventricular tachycardia, in other words, a very fast VTAC but without a pulse, then our method of choice is going to be defibrillation. There are not that many patients in this, but make sure that you can have a good look at your ECG and identify it. Early defibrillation is associated with better survival. I appreciate that not everybody will have a defibrillator. If you do not have a defibrillator, you can try an aggressive precordial thump. In other words, you literally whack the chest at the precordium just in front of the heart. It really is not that effective. Chemical defibrillation is not effective either. This is a situation that in many of these animals, they've probably got severe disease anyway. So it's a case of if you have access to a defibrillator, this is what we would do. But if you don't, in practice, there's nothing further that we can really do apart from attempt the precordial thump. Defibrillators come in two types. If you've bought an older one, it's probably a monophasic one, which is the one on the left of the screen here. And that one will actually need a higher energy to work effectively. The one on the right is a very new, very modern, essentially a human one, which will work very, very effectively because it's a biphasic one at lower outputs. It will tell you on it what type of defibrillator it is. So if you've got one, have a look at it and work out what you're going to do. If you've got a defibrillator, I would do exactly the same as your dose charts and write down exactly how many joules you need for each patient of each size. Then you don't need to remember. There are some fairly kind of strict things in relation to defibrillation that we need to be aware of. You do not want to be touching the patient or anything touching the patient when you defibrillate. And when you do it, you need to make sure that you deliver the instructions very clearly. I don't have time to go into this in a lot of detail. I appreciate that most of you don't have defibrillators. But if you're going down this road, if you've got the algorithm, you've got the equipment, make sure that you very, very clearly know how to use it, because potentially if you defibrillate a member of staff, you could have serious consequences. You don't stack shock. This is not Holby City. You don't give a shock and reshock again. You give the shock, see what the effect is on the ECG, on the rhythm, on the output, and you recompress whilst you're waiting for the defibrillator to recharge. And then you increase your energy for further shocks. That is defibrillation in a nutshell. I know there isn't a lot of information there. I'm very happy to answer further questions. The vast majority of cases are actually not going to be ventricular fibrillation or pulseless ventricular tachycardia. And they are the only two rhythms where a defibrillator will help. Essentially, they're rhythms with discordant activity. If you have no activity, such as asystole or pulseless electrical activity, then you can deliver as much shock as you like, but you've got no activity. You won't have anything to reset. In these situations, drug therapy is where we're going to go. And those drugs are going to be there to try and improve coronary and cerebral perfusion, try and restart the heart. You're going to deliver them ideally intravenously and ideally as close to the heart as possible. So if you have a central line, brilliant. If not, a cephalic IV. If this patient has just collapsed and you were not expecting them to do so, the first route of choice would be intratracheal, in which case you double the dose, dilute it, give it down a urinary catheter inside the ET tube. It will then go into the pulmonary vasculature very, very quickly. Do not ever give it intracardiac. What can happen is that you will turn an asystole, which you can resuscitate, into a fibrillation, which is much harder to resuscitate. This is not Pulp Fiction for those of us who are old enough to remember. The biggest drug on the most use, if you like, is epinephrine. If you're going to have one drug pre-drawn for CPR, I would make it epinephrine. It's an alpha and beta agonist. It vasoconstricts and it also increases the contractility of the heart, increases myocardial blood flow, and it has been shown to increase the return to spontaneous circulation. We normally start with the low end of the dose. The reason for that is that there is no benefit to the high end. It just makes more arrhythmias and makes more problems if you do get a return to spontaneous circulation. But if you have prolonged CPR, the patient gets more acidotic and you have more problems getting a return to spontaneous circulation, then after the third dose, I would increase to the top end of the dose range, if you like. That's arbitrary. It's in the guidelines, but it's very much based on, you know, the fact that the animals become more resistant to the drug with time because of the deteriorating condition. You're going to be giving it every 3 to 5 minutes, so essentially every other time you swap the person doing compressions. As I mentioned before, IV, central or peripheral, intratracheal, dilute and give it twice the dose. Intraosseous also works really well if you've got it. Interestingly, I went to a lecture at the RSM a couple of years ago, and the guy, Jerry Nolan, who does most of the big work on this in humans, said we really have no idea how much to give or if it's really useful. We just know that we get a high return to spontaneous circulation. So it's the one drug that has some evidence for some efficacy. You may have heard about vasopressin. Vasopressin was popular in the veterinary ICU literature and then kind of slightly disappeared. It's a drug that has a more, if you like, specific activity, and it preserves cerebral blood flow better. So it causes cerebral vasodilation. It's not in the current guidelines because there's no proven increase in return spontaneous circulation, increase efficacy. It's much more expensive than adrenaline. We have it, but we don't draw it, and we use it as per adrenaline or epinephrine. You know, feel free to use it. It may be that in the further guidelines, it will have more evidence, but at the moment, they suggest you use it every other cycle exactly as you would use epinephrine or adrenaline. Atropine has been in all our crash boxes for a very long time. It is absent from the human guidelines because it shows no benefit except in in-theatre arrests where you have excessive vagal tone, generally due to a surgeon having effects on on patients. This may well happen in our cases. You know, you're in theatre, somebody's messing about with doing a thyroid surgery. I call it messing about being an anaesthetist. And you get an increase in vagal tone, and then you get an arrest. Atropine is definitely beneficial in these cases. If you have high vagal tone, if you have an arrest that progresses observed through bradycardia, I would definitely use atropine. And it sits there on the recover guidance, but it's because we have little specific data to back it up. So brachycephalics, animals that have progressed through bradycardia, I certainly wouldn't be averse to using atropine as part of my resuscitation. Lidocaine is the other drug that we mentioned. It is primarily indicated for ventricular tachycardia where you have a pulse, so pre-arrest. When the animal has actually arrested, it can actually make it harder to defibrillate them if they fibrillate. So its primary use is in ventricular tachycardia where you have a pulse. So say that they have a rate of 180 VTAC, then lidocaine would be my first drug of choice. Be aware and remember that the therapeutic index is a lot lower in cats, so you need to start with a pretty low dose. Just putting this in for completeness, amiodarone is a drug that our cardiologists are quite fond of, and it's used in in ventricular fibrillation or pulseless ventricular tachycardia that's resistant to defibrillation, but it's a pretty nasty drug itself, so it's not something that I would generally recommend that everybody has. Again, if there are specific questions in relation to it, I can answer them. Should you use bicarbonate in CPR? Probably not, unless you have a very prolonged arrest, and probably not unless you have an ability to look at the blood gases. So if you're looking at venous blood gases, if you have a success, if you have access to something like an ISTAT, then it might well be worth it, but I certainly would not even consider it until at least 10 minutes in if you're doing a good job at maintaining a circulation but are unable to actually restart the heart, then it may be that improving the metabolic conditions may help. Generally speaking, after CPR, ventilating them and sorting the circulation out will sort out their metabolic acidosis. Calcium, basically, don't give it unless you know that there is hypocalcemia, hyperkalemia to protect the heart against arrhythmias, or a calcium channel blocker overdose. These are all pretty uncommon. It is there in our crash box, but we normally have to replace it because it goes out of date. It is not something that you would be looking for in the first 2 minutes, definitely. Definitely, you're going to want it available for things like hyperkalemic blocked CATs, that kind of thing, but it's not truly a resuscitation drug in the primary context. So we've had a bit of a look at the drugs. Everybody used to say give fluids during CPR, they're really important. Unfortunately, that's incorrect. High volume fluid therapy is not actually recommended. What it does is it decreases cerebral and myocardial perfusion, so it actually makes the situation worse unless they are actually hypovolemic. If they are hypovolemic, you need to think about why are they hypovolemic and replace the fluids that they've lost effectively. So that might be thinking about blood, it may be thinking about in order to get a rapid volume expansion, it might be hypertonic saline. Never ever give glucose during CPR unless you've got documented hypoglycemia. Glucose is involved in causing essentially death of cerebral cells by a lactate-mediated apoptosis, so just don't go there unless you've got a documented hypoglycemia. So if you're giving fluids, make sure you're giving them for a reason. Don't just pour them in. If the animal is euvolemic, just use enough fluid to make sure that the drugs are flushed into the circulation. So you've done all this, you've done a brilliant job, you've got a return to spontaneous circulation on your capnograph. Now what? I'm not going to go over this in much detail because we're at our hour already, but I'm just going to mention that there's much more information in those RECOVER guidelines, and in this I've put the post cardiac arrest syndrome guidelines, if you like. But what we're dealing with is a patient with potentially multi-organ failure, cardiogenic shock, in other words, the heart may now be beating, but it's not going to be beating well, and hypoxic or anoxic brain injury. If we don't look after this patient now, we've got a problem. So this is the algorithm that is in the RECOVER guidelines, and you can have a look at it more closely. We'll just highlight a few points. If arrest recurs, you have got a much worse prognosis. So if you get a return to spontaneous circulation, the animal has a cardiac arrest again very quickly, that's suggestive that the ongoing disease process is, if you like, more severe than your ability to return the circulation. Prognostically, that's a really bad thing. If it happens, I would actually consider saying, look, there's no point. You don't want to be getting a return to spontaneous circulation 5 or 6 times. It's just very difficult on everybody involved, and you're not doing the animal a favor. If you are successful, though, you need to think about prolonged life support, looking at the different systems. You want to think about hemodynamic optimization, so you need to think about monitoring blood pressure, looking for arrhythmias. This heart's had a pretty rough time. You want to make sure that you deal with any arrhythmias. You want to make sure that you try and optimize output. You want to maintain oxygen delivery, but not give too much oxygen. 100% oxygen is absolutely fine during CPR, but beyond that, we want just enough to maintain oxygenation. We don't want enough to cause oxidative damage. So yes, they want to be on oxygen, but not 100%. And if you've got pulse oximetry available, you want to be titrating an SpO2 around about 95%, not 100%. And you want to make sure that they can breathe well. I've had some successful post-cardiac arrest cases that we've had to ventilate for quite a long period of time. It's not like Holby City. You don't go home as soon as they get returned to spontaneous circulation. When you have the return to spontaneous circulation, we've got quite a lot of ICU to do. And this is actually where the costs mount up. You may be thinking about having to ventilate them for quite a while in order to get rid of all that CO2 debt and in order to make sure that they are actually in a better metabolic situation. One thing is, do not warm patients who've had a cardiac arrest. All my nurses all want to warm everything because they've been have it hammered into them that nothing ever gets cold. You're allowed to let your cardiac arrest patients get cold. Rewarm them very slowly. Hypothermia is widely used in human post-arrest care. It remains a bit controversial because of the quality of the studies, but in our patients, don't warm them, don't use the bear hugger, don't use all that expensive stuff that you've just bought. Let them warm up gradually. And it's possible that it might be useful to use hypertonic saline where you've got severe neurological deficits simply because it shifts fluid and helps with cerebral edema. But don't give corticosteroids. They don't do anything. They just cause hyperglycemia. They won't do anything except cause problems and actually make the outcome worse. Seizure prophylaxis, I wouldn't bother with unless you see evidence. Metabolic protection, we don't have any evidence for. So this guideline is in the RECOVER guidelines, but if you do really well, you get a return to spontaneous circulation, work your way through this, and you will be doing the best to get the best outcome for your patient. So thank you very much for your time and attention. Sorry that we're a few minutes over. But to summarize, don't resuscitate where it's not appropriate. Where you do resuscitate, make sure you can get trained people to where you want to resuscitate very quickly. Don't delay chest compressions. Get them started and get an airway as soon as you can. Assess your effectiveness, ideally with capnography. Once you've got that basic airway breathing circulation, get your other monitoring on and decide how you're going to manage that particular arrest rhythm. Teamwork is really, really important, and training is really, really important, as is post-cardiac arrest care. And I've just literally found out today that one of the nurses who I did the CPR training with a couple of months ago, who said she enjoyed it, was witness to a human cardiac arrest yesterday and actually led the arrest team based, because there were a load of bystanders there who did nothing, based on what, you know, what she'd learnt. And we found out this morning that the gentleman had survived, and that makes it all worthwhile. So if you can get a dog survive, great. If you can have that result, even better. So it is something that none of us are really, really happy with doing, but if you do it well, you can make a really big difference. Thanks very much for your time and attention. And there are just here a couple of links and resources for you to have a look at. Thanks again. Okay, so just had a question in that I've heard about, and the question was, how long do you carry on with CPR for if you haven't got a return to circulation? That's a difficult one. If you are being successful in terms of your effectiveness, the human guidelines, which are actually on the slide there, say 20 minutes. So if you're unable to get a return to spontaneous circulation within 20 minutes, then it's probably wise, it's probably acceptable to give up. If you are attempting to do CPR, but you know from your monitoring, you know from your capnograph that you're not generating an effective circulation, then to be honest, within 6 minutes you can say, because the animal will be brain dead. So if you're being effective, 20 minutes is a very good kind of ballpark. We've been going 20 minutes. We can't restart the heart. There's no point like carrying on. If you are unable to be effective with a method that you're using, then after 6 minutes of being ineffective effectively, you can stop at that point. Okay, thank you very much. Are there any more questions?
That's great. Thank you very much, Louise. On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Louise for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.